Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Earlier this week in our news, we talked about a new study out of Australia showing about a fifth of long haulers, people who got COVID and they continue to have effects after overcoming it, have suffered brain fog for more than a year. The research out of Australia tracked just under 130 patients for 12 months and found that some who experience long hauler syndrome, is what they're calling it, compared it to a traumatic brain injury. So I was fascinated by this. I wanted to learn a little bit more. And joining me this morning back on the show is Sarah Gromko. She's a speech language pathologist at St. Vincent's Rehabilitation Network. And good morning to you, Sarah. Thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So my understanding, Sarah, is that you're very up to date with the latest info on this. What can you tell us?
Well, beyond what was going on in Australia with their research, it's really, the research has been really vast and international. It's amazing how everyone's pulled together and gotten data from all of these different, electronic medical records to find all of this information. They're looking at cognitive aspects. They're looking at general aspects like fatigue and breathing, all of these things that are still affecting people months and months out from the infections.
And of course, we weren't going to know this until we really gave it some time. And I remember when I got COVID back in late 2020, I had the long hauler syndrome or whatever you want to call it. I was a long hauler for probably 4 to 5 months after I recovered from COVID. The brain fog and the just the fatigue and even the mood swings. Those were things I had never really experienced before. The brain fog, unfortunately, I think anybody who's pregnant does go through that, the whole mom brain thing. But, that was kind of the average. Doctors were saying, yeah, we're sort of anticipating long haulers could have these symptoms, these lingering symptoms for, 5-6 months after. But hearing that a minimum of a year could now be the reality, the average COVID long hauler, that's really significant.
Yeah. And the thing, I don't want to scare you here, Melissa, but the other thing is that they're noticing that it's sort of, you go into relapses. So sometimes it'll go away for a few months and then come back. So there's a lot of intervention that's really needed. And of course, a lot more studying of this as we are further and further out from the initial case.
So it's funny you say that, Sarah. It doesn't scare me only because I had a feeling that that was a reality. Over the summer, this past summer, I went through maybe a month of just my brain would go blank. Even on this show, I never take notes. I don't have one single note written right now talking to you. I don't have any pre-planned questions, nothing. I'm just shooting it with you. But last summer, honest to God, Sarah, if I had you on last summer, I would have had to written your name down and what company you are with, because 3 minutes into that interview, I would forget what your name was. And it was unbelievable because my mind, I will say, I'm not a brilliant person. I'm not any kind of a scholar, but I know I'm smart and I know I can remember things. But this was so apparent. And my husband actually did come up to me and goes, hey, I know we're not trying, but are you pregnant? What's going on? And I'm like, I have no idea. So I had a feeling that that was a real thing. And it's gotten obviously better. I don't know if working on it, your sharpness and continuing to kind of push your brain out of it is a way to overcome it. But what are you suggesting? If you've come across long haulers, how do they overcome that, especially if it's a relapse situation?
Well, what we're noticing most in the symptoms, at least cognitively, is it affects your processing speed. So just like you were saying, just taking a little bit to actually process new information and your memory. So what we as speech language pathologists do, we've been dealing with cognitive since pre-COVID. So we're actually using some of those strategies. But the really important thing is to embrace the fatigue and allow yourself to rest, allow your brain to rest when it needs it. And when you are able to exercise as much as possible, exercise your brain, exercise your body. There are brain exercises you can do to keep things sharp. And then, unfortunately, some people just have to learn how to do things differently. Like you said, you would have had to take notes, right? Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, that's the norm. So a lot of people that are coming in to see us, they never had to do that before. So we're basically teaching them how to live like normal people who would have to write things down.
It's a stark difference, though. It's so different when you've lived the same way your whole life. I mean, when I see a person's face, it's crazy. I could go away from them for 20 years and I remember their name and I remember how many cats they had. Like, that's just how my brain's always worked. But, like, don't ask me about anything in history because I don't remember anything from school. But, like, I remember things like that. And the fact that that went away again a second time was so frustrating. And I thought, what is happening? It's crazy. And so you do make the adjustments, but it's bizarre. It's very bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, even minimizing distractions and just focusing on one thing at a time, just really giving yourself that grace of, you know, processing things just a little bit more carefully.
We're talking to Sarah Gromko this morning, speech-language pathologist at St. Vincent's Rehabilitation Network. And I'm curious, Sarah, you said rest your brain, let your brain rest. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? I'm serious. I want to know. How do you rest your brain? I'd love to know. As a mother of a toddler and a news reporter and all the other stuff going on, you tell me how I rest my brain, and I will be forever grateful.
Exactly. Yeah. Sometimes it's just not practical, right? So you've got to sort of plan for those times when you're not going to be able to do that. Having people with, you know, having people to help, having the ability to sort of compartmentalize so that you can focus on one thing at a time, maybe even setting out a schedule where you really are allowing yourself to focus on one thing at a time rather than taking in lots of information and expecting yourself to retain it. When you're going through that, it's just so overwhelming. And unfortunately, our brains, well, maybe it's fortunately, our brains are going to just shut down if we put too much information and we're not processing things. You know how when you're learning something new and then you look at something and read it like five times, you're like, I did not retain that?
The story of my life, yes.
You've got to stop at that point because there is absolutely nothing that is going to go into your brain at that point, and you're actually making yourself more tired by trying to force it in when it's not going to do any good anyway. So you've really got to give yourself that grace.
So I should have just walked out of all my SAT classes or all my SAT, what's it called, the tests, because that's exactly what I think most people probably feel that way. I'm kind of making a joke, but it's true. You know, when you're sitting there and you're reading the same thing five times and you're like, I've retained zero of it. All you're doing is gassing a car that literally has run out of gas already, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's a really great analogy.
Interesting. Sarah Gromko is here. She is a speech-language pathologist. And a few days ago, I learned about a new study, and I know these studies are constantly coming out, updating since COVID came into existence. And we're learning a little bit more about long haulers. And, you know, Sarah, first of all, I remember bringing up long haulers maybe 6 months into COVID. And it's not really something that's front page news, which I think is interesting. A lot of people don't even know what a long hauler is. I think it's becoming a little more common. But I'm curious if you guys are seeing more people with the long hauler description attached to them. Because in the beginning, long haulers were kind of like 20, 30-year-olds in pretty good health. Like there was sort of like a demo of what a long hauler looked like. But has that expanded? Has that changed?
Well, from my anecdotal experience, what I'm seeing is consistent with what I've been seeing over the past 6 months. It's really people who are at such an extreme that they're just not able to function the way they were prior. These are really high functioning people, you know, really good jobs. And they're just like, why can't I concentrate at work? Mm-hmm. But I do want to mention that with the long haulers, it's not just cognitive, because if you think about it, cognition is affected by everything. If you are in immense pain, you're not going to be able to think, right? So if these people have any other symptoms that are long haul from COVID, then they're going to be affected by it. There was an international study that came out that's showing that of all symptoms, we've got 91% of people that are experiencing things 35 weeks out. Mm. So all of these things are going to be affecting us for quite some time, I think.
Is the vaccine helping?
And that's the thing that's frustrating. We don't have enough research out yet to really show if our inflammatory response, which is sort of the main theory about why we have long-haul COVID, if our inflammatory response that sort of changes our body chemistry and our body functioning is something that is going to be remedied with the vaccine.
Earlier in our chat, we're talking to Sarah Gromko this morning. Earlier you had said, Sarah, that people can exercise their brains, especially if they're going through brain fog or fatigue. What do you mean exercise mm-hmm. your brain? How do you do that?
There are lots of apps you can get on your phone to just be utilizing, especially memory for post-COVID people, really exercising your memory, crosswords, all of those nerdy games that people like to play. Those are all really, really great for your brain.
Mm-hmm. So stimulating your brain is good exercise.
Exactly.
Got it.
Exactly. Use it or lose it.
Exactly. Well, because I can remember even my grandmother when she was alive, she lived on the crossword puzzles, and we mm-hmm. used to kind of poke fun at her. But I mean, she lived well into her 80s, and she would say, look, I just want to keep my mind sharp. That's what I want to do. And we never really understood what she meant by that. But it's you know, the more you keep your brain moving and differently than what you were saying before, which is that when you're forcing your brain to either retain or take in information that maybe is work-related versus something that's enjoyable, like a game or maybe a good book that you really enjoy or something, that's different. That's good exercise for your brain versus gassing it out.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, we always, you know, try to teach kids you want to make learning fun, right? So if it's something that's salient, if it's something that you enjoy, that means something to you, you're going to retain it a lot better, and it's really going to sink in and exercise your brain in a much more effective way than if you're just learning something rote that's really boring. It's not going to really stick.
Mm-hmm. And as far as long haulers are concerned, Sarah, I think I had asked something similar to this, but do you agree? Do you think that the average now for people to have symptoms could be a year now? Like, do you agree with that, or is that just a stark change from I think it used to be like 4 to 6 months, I think was what used to be.
Well, technically that was the definition of long haul.
Oh, okay.
So they were basically saying that if you have something 3 months post, and now the CDC is just saying 4 weeks post, then that's considered long haul. That doesn't mean that that's when it ends.
I see.
That means that that's sort of the definition of it. But I mean, the UK study that came out last October shows it was a self-report granted by people in England, and they said that 42% of people were experiencing symptoms 1 year out and 19 2 years out.
Wow. That's unbelievable. I think this is just so fascinating. And the thing, like you said, Sarah, is that there's so much that we just don't know because it's only been a couple of years. But I thank you, Sarah. And if people are still going through their symptoms, if they consider themselves long haulers, should they be, you know, giving that information to anybody? Should they be adding to studies or anything like that? Because like you said, it's been a real collective effort here and across the globe So I would think the more voices you hear from, I would think that'd be helpful.
Absolutely. Getting this on your electronic medical record is really going to help with research, but it's also going to help you if you tell your doctor, listen, I'm going through this. I had COVID on such and such a date. Us having that data, it's going to be pulled anonymously from these records so that we can really look at thousands and thousands and thousands of people at once. So we could really get better data and really have better percentages so we know what to expect and what to prepare for.
Sarah Gromko, who is a speech-language pathologist, I thank you so much for coming back on the show. And thank you for all this information. I really appreciate it.
Sure thing. And good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Sarah. I didn't write your name down today, so you'll be happy to know. Hey, I did not have to write your name down today. Yes. Yes. Although I did definitely practice about 700 times this morning. Okay, I'm having Sarah Gromko on at 6:35. 6:35, Sarah Gromko. I'm just kidding. Sarah, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Thanks.
All right. Talk to you soon. That's Sarah Gromko here on WICC.
Melissa in the Morning spends a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Good morning, Senator Blumenthal. Thanks for stopping by. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me. Hope you and your listeners are well, too.
I think everybody is feeling hopeful. I think regardless of which side of the aisle you're on, I think people are feeling like, wow, we might see something significant happen in Congress for the first time in 30 years. Let's talk a little bit about this bipartisan gun safety bill. First of all, do you feel confident now that it will pass in time before recess, before the July 4th recess?
I am very optimistic that within the next 24, 36 hours, after 30 years, hundreds of thousands of gun deaths and dozens of failed pieces of gun safety legislation, we are finally going to take a step forward. And I am pretty hopeful, more than hopeful, pretty optimistic that it's going to occur in the next, let's say, 48 hours.
I mean, when I heard that this came to the floor on Tuesday night and even Mitch McConnell said, I'm behind this. I like this plan. I thought that to me was kind of a sealed deal. Now, of course, I don't want to jump ahead. Obviously, we need enough support for it to pass. But Mitch McConnell coming out and already saying he publicly supported it, I thought that was kind of a win. I think that's a win.
Some 14 Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, voted in favor of the procedural step to go forward on Tuesday evening, which is tremendous progress. But some of the Republicans are going to offer amendments in the hope of derailing the legislation today and possibly tomorrow. Our goal is to try to finish as soon as today, but we're prepared for obstructionism if it occurs. That's been inspired by the continued opposition of the gun lobby. It continues to have the power to intimidate and threaten a good number of members of Congress. But we have a very powerful movement, which is really driven by the groups like Connecticut Against Gun Violence, Sandy Hook Promise, and Newtown National Alliance, other grassroots groups, Brady and Giffords, who have really helped to spawn a movement, a real political movement. And so I'm very, very hopeful, even optimistic, that we are going to reach this significant positive step forward within the next 36 hours.
Senator Blumenthal, remind folks out there, how many Republicans does Congress need to pass this?
We need 10 Republicans to make 60 votes. There are 50 Democrats. And the filibuster rule requires a 60-vote threshold. So for the first time, Congress is going to authorize significant resources to support Connecticut and other states that have red flag laws, addressing a real barrier to implementing them that I've heard from officials and advocates throughout our state and the nation. We've substantially shrunk the boyfriend loophole that enables convicted abusers who are dating partners, not just spouses, to retain guns and kill their romantic partners. I'm proud that we're going to be channeling millions of dollars into Connecticut's Community Violence Intervention Program. I've met with many of them across the state of Connecticut, including in Bridgeport and Fairfield County. And I know as a former prosecutor how important the anti-trafficking and straw purchasing prohibitions will be to addressing the scourge of gun violence in Connecticut and other states around the country. And then, of course, there's the multi-billion dollar investment in healthcare resources, mm-hmm. principally mental health care, behavioral health. And all of it amounts to a very significant positive step forward.
I agree. And Senator Blumenthal, I'm glad you brought up the mental health portion of this, because here's the takeaways that I'm just curious about. Look, I think if this passes, I'm just glad it's here. I mean, better late than never. But I was kind of curious about that. You know, both sides of the aisle have made it super clear since the start of the pandemic in different ways that mental health has been a real problem. We've heard from both Republicans and Democrats here in Connecticut and across the country say our kids are struggling. Our kids really fell behind. They went into dark places. They've had social isolation. They've had a boatload of things go wrong in these last couple of years. And I was surprised that we waited for an anti-gun violence bill to put forward billions of dollars in mental health. So my question, I guess, is why did we wait for this? But also, if the gun bill doesn't pass, will lawmakers come back to the table after recess and say, hey, we still need to invest in mental health? Because whether or not there's gun violence in the United States, I think everyone on both sides agrees that mental health is a massive problem.
As you know, I have championed this gun violence prevention bill along with my colleague, Senator Murphy, who helped negotiate it. And we've also sought more support for mental health care and behavioral health care, school safety, insofar as counseling and therapy on school campuses are concerned, so we can catch dangers before they produce violence. And mental health should not be conflated or identified as the same as gun violence prevention, because a lot of people with mental health issues are not dangerous. But the point is that we should be devoting more resources to mental health wholly apart from the gun violence issue. You're absolutely right. We should have done it a while ago. We're in the midst of a mental health crisis, particularly for our children, because they've been through such trauma over the past years, really, the last 2 to 3 years, the isolation, anxiety, stress, and of course, it's produced increases in domestic violence, in opioid addiction, fentanyl overdoses. The costs are just huge, and we do need to address this mental health crisis, separate and apart from gun violence prevention, but obviously, if we can do it as part of this bill, so much the better. Some people who commit these horrendous massacres give signs of mental health issues beforehand. If we can catch those problems upstream before they produce violence, when people go over the rapids and waterfalls downstream, all the better. But a lot of mental health issues result in people becoming victims of violence. And in fact, the majority of people with mental health issues are more likely to be victims than perpetrators.
Right. But if the gun safety bill doesn't pass, do you think lawmakers will go back and create either a separate bill or do something? Because, again, I think everybody is praising the fact that this bill includes, as you mentioned, billions of dollars for mental health. So if this bill doesn't pass, essentially we're right back to square one and we're not investing in mental health.
I'm going to think positively on a rainy Thursday morning. It's rainy down here in D.C. And I'm going to think positively about the passage of this measure. It's a compromise. If you wait for everything in Congress, you're likely to get nothing. Progress is better than nothing. And we're making progress here on gun violence and on mental health. Certainly, if for some reason the gun violence bill fails, we need to invest in mental health. There should be a multi-billion dollar support program for mental health facilities like our community health centers in Connecticut, many in around the state, 17, I believe it is, including in Bridgeport and elsewhere in Fairfield County. The mental health needs of this nation are so pressing and important. We should invest right now.
Senator Blumenthal, thank you for coming on this morning. And next time we'll chat will be in July. So I will talk to you after the 4th of July weekend. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Talk to you soon. That's Senator Blumenthal here on WICC. It may be very relaxing for you at the end of the day. Maybe you want to just decompress. And a lot of times doctors will say a weighted blanket can really help you with that, make you feel good. I know for myself, I have a weighted blanket and I love the feel of it. My husband feels the same way. And there are some really great benefits to weighted blankets, but there are some concerns with it, especially if you're talking about younger children and weighted blankets. So joining me this morning, welcoming back to the show, is Miriam. Miriam Syed. Dr. Syed has been here before, and she is a family medicine physician with Hartford Healthcare. And actually, she's got an office out in Westport. And we're going to talk about some of the dangers of weighted blankets and young children. Good morning, Dr. Syed. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about some of this new information. Where did this come about, the weighted blankets?
So basically, earlier this week, American Academy of Pediatrics released some updates to its safe sleep guidelines. A lot of it is sort of reiteration of things that have been promoted in the past as safe sleeping habits, and some of the guidelines are new. And the recent guidelines suggest that it is safest for a baby to sleep on a firm, flat surface, not surrounded by anything such as weighted blankets, such as toys, anything soft, plush, crib bumpers, things like that. Weighted blankets specifically have, because the babies have not developed fine motor skills, they can actually be very harmful while a child is sleeping, as it can obscure their face and then prevent them from breathing appropriately, eventually leading to sudden infant death.
So I always thought with weighted blankets, one of the concerns I always thought was that they just can't move. Because they're just not strong enough. Their muscles are just not strong enough to maneuver with those blankets. Is that a concern?
That's certainly one of the biggest concerns, because the baby has not developed any motor skills to actually respond to that weight that may be coming on their face. So that is largely part of the concern. But it goes with the big picture of how we're trying to promote safe sleeping habits amongst everybody, because it's sort of weighted blankets are part of the bigger picture of different methods we can use to sort of promote safe sleeping in children. And there are other things involved as well. So I don't want everybody to focus just on weighted blankets. It's pretty much similar to other things such as, like I said, soft toys, blankets, things like that. We just don't want the babies to be surrounded by them, because you're sleeping, you're tired. And if you do not, realize that the blanket got on the baby's face or anything else for that matter, like plush toys, and the baby's not able to move it, they can suffocate to death.
Now, we're talking this morning to Dr. Syed. I'm a little taken aback, Dr. Syed, and I think a lot of people might be as well. When we talk about young children, I mean babies, obviously, mm-hmm. Wasn't there a report, I can't even remember where it was, but it was back in May, and it was like this breakthrough with SIDS, for anyone who's not familiar, sudden infant death syndrome, that it wasn't, in fact, bumpers and toys and blankets that were causing SIDS. that it was in fact kind of an underlying condition, essentially. Was that report accurate? Was that only like a half truth? Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So there are multiple causes of SIDS. So I wouldn't say that that was inaccurate. I think SIDS is one of those things that's being widely studied, and I don't think we know 100% of the cause of SIDS. So certainly there is study. There are studies going on about whether there are some genetic components, certain underlying medical issues, certain congenital disorders that may be potentially also leading to SIDS that we do not recognize in young babies because they haven't been worked up for it and there has been no signs. So that is certainly contributing to it, but we still have a large amount of population and a large amount of deaths, actually 3,500 deaths every year in the United States, where a large portion of them are contributed secondary to external factors that we can control, such as blankets, bumpers, things like that. So yes, you're right in the sense that there have been studies that have shown that there are alternative causes, sometimes beyond our control, but a large part is still secondary to the external factors.
And another thing, Dr. Syed, okay, so I understand the baby portion of this segment, but when is it, in your professional opinion, appropriate for children to start using weighted blankets? Because I know for myself, it was something I debated for our son. He has high anxiety and he gets nervous with loud noises. And one of the things I had thought was, hey, something that calms me down. I'm not anxious, but I have very high energy and it's hard for me to settle down at the end of the day. But a weighted blanket does calm me. It centers me. But I don't know why. I think to myself, a toddler is still too small for a weighted blanket, but maybe I'm wrong, and I don't mean an adult one. I know they make kids ones. What is your recommendation? When is it appropriate? What age is appropriate to start allowing children to use weighted blankets?
So I think I don't think there is an age we can define as, okay, by 6 months or 1 year, they can use the weighted blankets. I do think it's individualized to the children and their motor skills that they have developed. Actually, the new guidelines that have come up recently, American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended not co-sleeping, but sleeping in the same room as children until the age of 6 months. So there's you definitely want that supervision, not, we don't want them right next to you, but you want them in the same room so you can be aware of what's going on. I guess most kids would probably be past that 1 to 2 year mark, will be old enough to use weighted blankets because they should have some skills to move the blanket away safely once they're that age group. But however, if you have a child, because each child grows differently, if you have a child that has not developed their fine motor skills, that haven't learned to walk yet, that have, they have not that great of upper body strength, then you have to use your judgment and not use the weighted blankets until you have determined that they have developed those skills.
Interesting. And Dr. Syed, I really appreciate you coming on this morning, a family medicine physician with Hartford Healthcare, Medical Group in Westport. Thank you so much for your time.
No problem.
Dr. Syed here on WICC.